We Are History with me, Angela Barnes.
And me, John O'Farrell. What are we talking about today, Angela?
This is a fun one today because it's the last one in our series. It's a bit like the equivalent of on the last day of term when they let you bring games in and just play all day.
This is games history.
We are having a fun one today. We are talking about the very serious topic of Eurovision.
Eurovision Song Contest, indeed.
Yes. I think people will think that I chose this, but actually, I just want to make it clear that Mr. John Sirius O'Farrell chose this.
Le Grand Prix Eurovision de la Chanson Européenne.
Ooh, have you been practicing that?
No, I've got three French O levels. I kept failing and kept getting an O, so kept failing the A level. Yes, sometimes, you know, usually history is stuff that's important and world changing and, you know, has consequences. But sometimes you can look at history and it's the way that you can witness those changes taking place. And I think that's what Eurovision is. It's not a Viking invasion, notwithstanding Norway's 1992 entry. It's not the Black Death, you know, but it is a way in which we can sort of monitor the shifting cultural and musical and social attitudes across the continent.
It's sort of a filter, isn't it, to look at history through.
It's a mirror in which we see ourselves, Angela.
Yes, it is.
But also,
well, we're both
chance.
Sort of quite obsessive about 20th century European history. Yeah. That's how, or certainly my obsession. So to see it through what happened in the Eurovision Song Contest is quite interesting.
Yeah, and you see changes in, you know, borders, power blocks, preferred languages. And also, you know, the Will Ferrell film is just out, very timely. I saw
You'd
that,
seen
I quite
it,
enjoyed
you?
It. I did, I thought it was quite fun. I mean, it's too long, like the Eurovision Song Contest, actually. It's got some good jokes in it, and it's good fun. It's very much in the spirit of Eurovision, with loads of cameos from various Eurovision stars in it. So, yeah, it's recommended if you don't expect too much.
Yeah. I think if you're going in to watch a Will Ferrell film expecting too much, then that's really on you, isn't it?
So the book I think we both read for this was Eurovision by Chris West.
Yes, indeed.
Which tracks the history of the continent along with the competition. So it's sort of like the Berlin Wall came down, but at Eurovision, you know, so he sort of tries to crowbar the two together, but it's a good fun read. It does it sort of year by year.
And it is, although it's, you know, some of the history in it is sort of more opinion than fact, I think it's quite a good little romp through the shape of the 20th century history, isn't it? It's
absolutely. Like, quickly get through sort of, you know, the financial crash or whatever, or gas used to gay people. That's all interesting to have in context. So should we start at the beginning?
Start at the very beginning. So World War II has finished.
No.
I like to go back a bit, you know
okay,
me.
That's good, yeah.
and we're in a Europe where we're trying to foster positive relations, aren't we?
Yes, very much so. Part of that is the EBU. The European Broadcasting Union was based in Switzerland. And the Italian there, Sergi Pugliese, suggested a Europe-wide song festival, like something they had in Italy already.
There was the San Remo Music Festival.
That's right.
It already existed in Italy.
Yes. And this would be an experiment in live broadcasting, which was quite a big deal in 1955 when this was conceived. But you have to remember in 1955 also, across the continent of Europe, seven people had televisions.
So
the idea of, this will bring the countries together. Well, it'll bring the rich people together.
It'll bring, at least 50 people together. I think it's worth sort of remembering as well, you know, this is pre-satellites. Like, to broadcast across the continent was quite a feat.
There's a bit of footage you can see on YouTube of Richard Dimbleby broadcasting live from Calais. And they make such a... This is 1950. And they say they make such a massive deal that these pictures are coming to you live across the English Channel. And this was, you know, only 5 years earlier. So to have... To try and coordinate all the voting and the singing and everything and broadcast it across the continent, it was an ambitious project in 1955.
Absolutely.
So the first year then was 56.
Mm-hmm.
Year of Elvis Presley, the year of political turmoil, and the year of some rather staid men in dinner jackets standing by pianos in black and white in blurry televisions and ladies in ball gowns singing in French.
Not quite the sort of spandex-laden feast that we know today, was it, in 1956?
No, and it was very,
just
just seven countries, very much the sort of core countries that sort of founded the European Union as well, really. It's those, if you exclude Switzerland, it's those sort of Benelux countries, the Low Countries, and Germany, France, Italy.
So it was West Germany, Belgium, France, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands and Switzerland were the core.
Right.
And apparently Austria, Denmark and the United Kingdom wanted to enter, but they got their forms in late.
Okay, that's it. That's the
so didn't
the French people were saying no, it's pas possible.
C'est tout tard. It was De Gaulle going no. No,
go to Lost Property, fourth floor. So it was held in Switzerland, the very first one. Now Luxembourg couldn't send two judges, so they asked the Swiss if they would fill those two spaces.
Tina, shush.
Guess who won that year, Angela?
Now let me do the maths. Switzerland had two extra judges. Yes. You're telling me. Who won?
And they won by one vote. The Swiss allegedly won by one vote, so it was fixed from the very beginning.
Of course, it was all behind closed doors voting, wasn't it then? It wasn't like now where you have the scoreboards and the phone Absolutely. In and everything. Yeah, and that first one was, I think it was 58 when it became more open, the voting.
Yes, and they had two songs each in that very first year because there were only seven countries and they thought, how are we going to pad this out? Not a problem these days, let it be said.
No, no.
The UK managed to enter the following year. Finished seventh.
Got their forms in on time.
They got their forms in time, but finished seventh out of nine. The phrase Eurovision was coined by a British journalist, George Campy, of the London Evening Standard.
Eurovision refers to the Broadcasting Union, doesn't it? Because it was coined in 51, long before the song contest is now associated with. Did you know they came together in a hotel in Torquay? That's when that Broadcasting
really?
Union was formed. Yeah.
Don't mention the war. Exactly. I mentioned it once, but I think I got away with it. Oh God! I did not know that. Oh, that's a good bit of trivia.
There you go.
So in the '50s, as I say, it was a very staid and conservative event with rock and roll sweeping America and Europe. So it wasn't really in tune with the music of the time. But in 1959, the UK came second.
Ooh.
And Britain, can you believe it, holds the record for being runners up.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we used to have a real advantage, I think, for singing in English.
Yeah.
But when everyone was supposed to sing in their native language.
Well, the rules kept changing with that, didn't they? I think we'll come to that in a bit. But I think if you sang in French or English, you were at a major advantage because they were the two languages that were most widely understood across Europe.
It was sort of dominated by French language, really, in the early years, with Luxembourg, Belgium, Monaco coming in later, France, obviously, Switzerland. So
you had, the chansons were very popular in the 50s, weren't they?
Yes,
you're sort of
Edith Piaf's, Charles Trenet, that sort of, that style. One very early hit came out in 1958, Volare. Is that how you pronounce it? Volare, Volare?
Volare.
Volare.
Volare,
okay.
Oh.
See, I don't know how that goes. I don't know this song.
Oh, you do know it. You definitely know it. If you've ever been in a lift in your life, then you know that song.
Okay. Well, it was a US number one. It was covered by Dean Martin, Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, even Cliff Richard. So it must be quality.
Oh, well.
That was the first sort of really big hit to come out of Eurovision.
And that was 1958. So that was the third one.
Yeah, that was Italy's hit, which I don't think won. Mm. It was the beginning of a tradition of Eurovision songs that were the most popular on the night but didn't sway the judges. Mm. There's been a few of those down the years. Always very non-political. They didn't allow political messages or protest songs.
A few snuck in though, right?
They did. 1961. Do you want to talk about that?
In 1961, we had Nous les Amoureux by Jean-Claude Pascal. And it was a story of forbidden love. Love forbidden by religion. And a wish that he and his lover could carry on their relationship without controversy. So it was clearly a song about being gay.
It was a time when homosexuality was illegal across most of Europe.
So that was, 61? Yeah.
61, and it came first. They voted for it. Maybe they didn't really know what they were singing about. But
they did, and, it was a little point
little
to be made.
That's good. Yeah, I think we should go for that. They saw the politics.
Yeah, let's say that.
But gay people would never show any interest in Eurovision ever again.
That's right, John. Yes, that was the first and last time homosexuality was ever linked to Eurovision.
There was a protest in 1964. Protesters invaded the stage and unveiled a banner saying, "Boycott Franco and Salazar." Who were the Spanish and Portuguese dictators.
Between them, Spain and Portugal that year only got 1 point. So the judges obviously went, right, we're not having that.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Yeah, so maybe they were boycotting the protester or boycotting the dictators. Who knows?
Well, I think probably because it was supposed to not be overtly political, that was probably the Eurovision judges' way of going, now, come on.
We're not, right, you know. OK. But they had to quickly, you know, deal with this sort of, they'd not had anything like this before. So it's quick cut to camera two. Do we have a camera too? How many cameras? Yeah. But it was not really something they'd expected, but it would not be the last time, as we saw quite recently.
No. And then in 1965, that was the year that they brought in the rule that all songs had to be in the native language of the country.
Ah, right. Trivia.
Yeah, and that's when the Francophone and English songs really got an advantage then, because if, you know, Norwegian songs were having to be sung in Norwegian and no one else understood Norwegian, that puts them at, you know, if you can't understand the lyrics, put them at a bit of a disadvantage with the judges.
Yeah, good point. I'm 2% Norwegian, Angela, so that offends
me. Are you? So. How'd you work out 2%?
Well, it's one of those DNA things they had done. Right. So, yeah.
Your DNA thing.
I'm 56% Irish, 40 something percent English, 2% Norwegian, a little bit Narnia, a little bit Narnia in there.
It's the hooves.
It's the hooves, it's a giveaway. But yeah, no, I had one of those tests. So countries like Finland and Norway were suffering from not having been forced to sing in their own language.
That rule did change over time.
It went back and forth.
It kept changing and then changing back again. And I'm not sure exactly how it stands now, but
I think now you can sing whatever you want, can't you?
Yeah, I think
Most of the languages were ring-a-ling-a-ling, bing-bang-bong, ding-a-ding-ding.
Well, yeah, but I think that's why there were so many of those silly sort of Eurovision choruses, you know, with your boom-bang-a-bangs, and because they did translate, as it were. You could, have nonsense words.
I'm just jumping ahead a bit, but when the Spanish winner La 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 was recorded, which was, I think, 68... the original was sung in Catalan, and Franco said, no, you've got to have it in Castilian Spanish. So La 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 had to be in Spanish, not La 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 in Catalan.
Which is a very big difference.
Absolutely.
La 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 in Castilian and Catalan.
But 1966, there was the first black singer from the Netherlands. Mm. Well done, Netherlands.
Yeah. Although, you know, it took 10 years before they had a black singer. They'd been an Indonesian, I think,
The
Netherlands.
The year before.
An Indonesian singer the year before. But her name was Millie Scott, the first black singer in Eurovision. But unfortunately, they gave her a bit of a rubbish novelty song sing. Her song was called, it was something like Fernando the Filipino.
Fernando? That's never going to be
Fernando
good,
the
is it?
Filipino was the name of her song. So, and it only got 2 votes. There you go.
There's just a segue here, but just to completely change the subject. My daughter made me watch Mamma Mia 2 the other night. This is slightly Eurovision related, since it's an ABBA feature. But there's a bit where Cher looks across the room at old man and goes, Fernando? It's like, what song are they going to do now? When I was in the cinema, I saw that.
Are they going to do Chiquitita next? Are they?
The whole cinema burst out laughing when that happened. It's like, really? What's his name? Fernando. Excellent work. Oh, well done, those guys.
There was a little bit of a feminist moment in 1966. We had the first black singer, and we had the first time a lady appeared. Wait for it, John. Are you sitting down? Wearing trousers.
That's... What is happening to the world?
What were Norway thinking? Now, I'm going to... My Norwegian pronunciation's not good.
Again,
her name
you're
is spelt...
Me.
I think it's something like Asia Cleveland.
Yeah.
Asia, that, it's A-S-E, but I think it'd be like Asia, maybe Asia.
Yeah, as I'm part Norwegian, I'll just nod, yeah.
Okay, yeah, you just tolerate. But she went on to be Norway Minister of Culture.
Under Gro Harlem Brundtland. Yes.
Yes.
So we're doing some good Norwegian today. But yeah, let's just get down to the really important historical stuff. I said this wasn't important historically, but 1967, UK wins. Come on.
Get in. We've done World Cup 66, next, Eurovision 67.
What a
bang,
what,
bang.
Bang, bish, bash, bosh. Sandy Shaw in her bare feet singing Puppet on a String.
Yeah. Now, John, what did you admit that you didn't realise till about a year ago?
That Sandy Shaw is a pun.
How did you miss that?
Sandy Shaw. See, she's walking on the Sandy Shaw in her bare feet.
Yes.
I just got that. I'm so sorry. I have to say, my music on my focus in the 60s was, I hope, on better music than that. At the time of the Beatles and the Stones and the Kinks, you know, we sent Cliff in 1968.
Even Sandy Shaw wasn't keen on Puppet on a String.
No, she didn't love that song. She's... No.
No.
But, you know, Swinging London came to Eurovision with her, you know, dancing around in her bare feet, and good for her.
Yeah.
In 68 with Cliff, he just lost out to Spain. And the rumour, which I'd like to believe, is that Franco bribed the jury to secure a Spanish victory. And it's definitely true that, because I read it on the internet.
I mean... There's a lot of questions there.
Yeah,
aren't there?
Let's unpack that.
Yeah. How exactly he bribed the jury?
It's on the internet, Angela. You can't argue with that.
Yep. Those Cliff Richard conspiracy theorists are the worst.
So his song was Congratulations, but he came second. So it's sort of like, well, semi-congratulations, Cliff.
It was La La La, the song we talked about before.
That's right, yeah. But Lulu comes back in 69 with Britain. Is she going to win it? Who's going to be the outright winner? Is the outright, she's singing Boom Bang A Bang, Boom Bang A Bang, I Love You.
She
wins, but so do three other countries. And they had they had no mechanism for dealing with this. So it was like a four-way tie.
Well, didn't they have the sort of adjudicator was weirdly on set, like sat at a desk or something, I read. And the host sort of turned to him and went, what do we do? There's a four-way tie. And he went, they all win. And it's like, oh, okay. How are we going to do this?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, did they all win then? Okay. And that was the policy, basically. So, yeah. And then the following year, the British Isles is represented again. And someone who came from somewhere within the British borders, but she's playing for Ireland, and it's Dana. Straight to Dana. Number one with All Kinds of Everything. Now, that was a
lovely Dana. This is she was only young, wasn't she?
She was like 19 or something. She was like this sweet pub singer from Derry.
All Kinds of Everything.
Oh, it could be Dana. Remind in the room. Is this Dana?
Of
Take off that Angela Barnes mask. So this was a massive deal in my house, my dad being Irish. This is the year that the Troubles broke out in Northern Ireland.
When she was from Derry, right?
She was from the Bogside. Yeah. And she'd done all her performing in the south, in Dublin and places. But there she was, representing Ireland. And then you look it up on YouTube, her coming back from Eurovision. They're all waiting at the airport. So, Dana, you got any more hits in the verse next, Dana? Oh, I've hardly had time to even think about it. It's all been so unbelievable. And all the nuns are there taking her away and sort of applauding her. And they're sort of, it's a great moment for Ireland, really.
Yeah,
she went
on
to be a member of the European Parliament for Connacht.
Yeah.
Ran for president. I think she had some pretty dodgy abortion views, so we'll just concentrate on her lovely song.
Unfortunately, quite mainstream in Northern Ireland.
And Ireland. She was in the south.
Ireland, yeah.
But UK runner-up that year was Mary Hopkins. So we're second again with... Do you remember this song? Mm-hmm. Knock, knock, who's there? Mary Hopkins, do you remember that one? Oh, God. Okay.
Before my time, John, I don't...
I know, you weren't born.
I wasn't born in 1970, I'm afraid.
Oh, God. We were sitting around at Spitting Image once, and we had this. We thought we'd play a trick on the producer, Bill Dare. We said, let's pitch the worst comedy idea that we can think of and all pretend it's hilarious. And we got the runners and everyone to be in on it. So we said to Bill Dare, we've got this song idea, Bill. It's about Neil Kinnock. You ready? Yeah. It's a great one, Bill. Kinnock, Kinnock, who's there? This must be Labour calling. And we all fell about laughing. And he's going, I don't get it. What's the joke? Did Bill, Kinnock, Kinnock, you know Neil Kinnock and the song Knock Knock, yeah? Kinnock, Kinnock, who's there? This must be Labour calling. And then the runner comes in and we go, look, do it to him. And he was brilliant. He fell about laughing and was going, oh, you've got to do that, Bill. That's brilliant. He's going, I just don't see it. It seems a bit shit. And we kept it going for ages. So every time I hear Knock Knock, there's there.
Do you
all
know
I can hear
what,
is...
though? That, to me, shows that Bill Dare is a great person at his job, because anyone who wasn't a great producer would have gone, well, they all think it's funny. I'd better laugh
do it.
And join
in. I think it's a bit shit.
Which I think I might have been in that latter camp. I bet I would have gone, oh, God, they all find this funny and I don't get it. I'd better laugh.
Complete... diversion there, but Mary Hopkins coming second again. 1971, 18 countries.
Ah, but hang
now.
On a minute, you've missed out. Come on, who made their debut in 1970, John?
Former goalkeeper of Real Madrid, Julio Iglesias.
Your mother loves him.
To all the girls I loved before.
There's going to be a lot of singing in this episode.
A lot of pub singing. We should have done it at a pub.
I apologise. I would like the listeners to remember that I am hard of hearing and my singing definitely reflects that. So I apologise now.
1971, UK countered the victory of Dana from Catholic Northern Ireland by entering an Ulster Protestant. Mm. Poor Clodagh Rodgers, she got death threats from the IRA. And UK didn't win, but by 1971, it was really a big deal, Eurovision. Mm. 18 countries taking part, all in Western Europe, of course. 250 million viewers by now.
That's incredible.
Yeah. In 72, the Irish entered a song in Gaelic, so good luck with that. Absolute disaster.
Yeah.
But it's true, the singing in English was a huge advantage, as you say, which is why we kept coming second. But after 1973... countries didn't have to sing in their native language. And this probably done to annoy the French.
So the French were always did well, didn't they? Because
French language songs were always winning it, yeah. So you could say that this was when the French language dominance on the competition...
Where's this going?
It met its Waterloo.
Yeah,
I'm just
going to
do that. I think I could do that again. It was as if the French language dominance of the competition had met its Waterloo. Welcome back. We left you with Waterloo by the ABBA group, as they were introduced in 1974.
I love that. Why didn't they stick with that?
Yes, their conductor had come on dressed as Napoleon, and everyone thought, oh, this is going to be awful. This was all down in your manor, Angela, down in Brighton.
It was, at the Dome in Brighton.
Where famous comedian Angela Barnes lives. If you listen to that now on YouTube, if you listen to them singing Waterloo, it sounds a bit karaoke, actually. It's not as good as the one you just heard, but they were the runaway winners and became the most successful act ever launched by the competition.
It's weird to think, isn't it, that no one knew who ABBA was before?
No, they were just, I mean, they were known in Sweden, I think. But I think they became Sweden's biggest export in the late 70s. That's bigger than amazing. Volvo, you know, was ABBA records.
Wow.
Something else interesting about the 1974 competition, Portugal's entry was the signal to launch the Carnation Revolution. You heard us talking about Salazar, the Estado Novo dictator.
Estado Novo regime. Yeah.
There was an uprising against that dictatorship, which was triggered that when the Portuguese song was played on the Portuguese radio, not in the competition itself, but just beforehand. And that was the signal to take over the important places like the post office and the telephone exchange.
It was quite a civilised coup, wasn't it? Apparently, no shots fired.
No shots. It was called the Carnation Revolution because it's so peaceful. And the following year, in 75, the Portuguese singer wore a red carnation in his lapel as a little marker. So well done, Portugal. So once ABBA had become so successful, everyone tried to sort of start copying that two guys, two gals thing. So 76, England comes along with Brotherhood of Man, the poor man's ABBA. But runaway winner.
Kisses for me.
Kisses for me, save all your kisses for me. I was on my French exchange.
The song is really creepy till it gets to the last line and then you go, oh, actually, all right, not so creepy.
She's three though. I don't know.
John, come on now.
It's just a bit, it's the shit song. But outsold Waterloo. Can you believe it? Sold more copies than Waterloo.
Did it really?
Yeah, incredible.
Wow.
But not much more than ABBA altogether, I suppose. Of course, all this time, the Eastern Bloc were looking over and thinking, oh, this isn't fair. We want to be part of that. So they invented their own Eurovision called Intervision.
Intervision. What I love about it is that Finland entered both Eurovision and Intervision.
Well done, Finland.
Finland sort of straddled the east-west divide there, quite literally.
Good for them. Did you read about how this was voted upon?
Yes, So it was done by people in the country were told to turn on their lights if they liked a song.
Yeah.
And turn off their lights if they didn't. And so it would be measured on the national grid as to which songs were most popular.
From each country. Each national grid had somebody there going, it's going up, it's going down on the sort of consumption of electricity. And that's how Chernobyl happened.
Yeah. It's quite an assumption that everybody is watching it,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. Or they might
people
just, be putting
just randomly turning their lights on, putting the kettle on.
Yeah, they might say, I'm just going to make a cup of tea. What's the
whatever.
Other channel? But yeah, the EBU, of course, wasn't just Western Europe. It included countries outside of Europe. And 1972, Israel had started taking part. Every time the Israel song came on, Arab countries would cut to a commercial break. But in 78, Israel looked like the runaway winner. And so Jordan stopped broadcasting altogether and just put up a picture of some daffodils.
So, nothing to see here. Just look at this.
And 78 was when Norway got null point. That was the that was the famous Norway null point. And they always do impressions, don't they, of Royaume-Uni null point. But nobody ever says that because you only get points when you're voted for. So they don't,
oh, yes.
So it's a sort of a myth, I think.
Do they at the end, though, maybe? I suppose if you've got 0 points at the end when they do the roundup, suppose they'll say nul point. And I think, because you don't... That's a really good point. That never occurred to me before. Why would you say the people that you gave no points to?
So, into the 80s. We're into the 80s, Angela.
Now we're getting into my era, John. 1980 is quite interesting. Because of the oil price crisis in 79... Everyone was skint, so no one wanted to host it.
Right.
So the Dutch volunteered in the end. Yeah. And one of my best mates is Dutch, one of my bridesmaids, in fact. And if she's
anything
to go by...
She's from Holland.
She's from the Netherlands. And if she's anything to go by, like, they are... she is Eurovision mad, and you can't take the piss out of it with her.
Okay.
Wow. Serious stuff.
But it's so taken the
piss. She loves it.
It's so taken the piss out of itself now, isn't it, Eurovision? That's what's the sort of joy
of
it, really.
It is now, but I do think, like, she properly loves it. And, the Dutch, they volunteered to host it in 1980. And who won that year? It was good
Ireland.
Old Johnny Logan.
Second of many wins for the Emerald Isle.
Yeah, well, he's the only person ever, isn't he, Johnny Logan, to have won it twice. And the second time he won it was in 1987 with a song called Hold Me Now, which was one of my dad's favourite songs. And it is bloody awful, but
it
still makes me cry because it reminds me of my dad.
He also composed another winning song as well. So he's won it twice, written two songs that have won it. It's also the year you start to get those So Good It's Bad entries. Luxembourg did a song called Papa Penguin. And it basically... It was dressed. The bloke was dressed up as a penguin, I think. Oh no, it was a backing singer dressed in a giant penguin costume, and he tripped over a stair 11 bars into it. And I don't think the singer ever really recovered. But it'd be good to have imagined what Terry Wogan or Katie Boyle were saying in the background.
We'll come on to Terry Wogan a bit later, won't we? But the year he started hosting it regularly was 1980.
Oh right, because he'd done it on Irish radio, I think, back in the day.
But, yeah, he did it a couple of times in the 70s, the commentary, but then he started doing it every year from 1980.
81, another UK win. This is hard to remember, isn't it? Bucks Fizz ripping their skirts off.
One of my favourite lines of a song ever.
Which is?
Don't let your inhibitions take you from behind.
Okay. Why is that so interesting?
Don't know. No idea, John.
And there was a sort of a cheeky thing, wasn't it? There was sort of another two gals and two guys sub ABBA thing.
Yes.
But everyone remembers the skirts coming off halfway through the song. It's like, oh, that's marvellous. Oh, I like that. And it's like,
yes, vote for them.
Vote for them with their skirts coming off.
It is a good tune, though, Making Your Mind Up.
It's all right.
It's a good pop song. Don't be a snob.
It's no Dana. 82. This is your... I think I'm going to hand over to you now because you've got things... My notes came back to me with about 10 paragraphs here from Angela.
Yes, I'll skip over it, but 82 was my vintage Eurovision year, the best one ever. For a start, I had the first ever Eurovision rock guitar solo from Finland. They came last, but, started a pattern.
Fantastic.
But I have 2 7-inch singles that I still own from 1982 Eurovision. And the first is the British entry, which was Bardo, One Step Further. I sat down with my parents. Five-year-old I would have been then. Angela sat down with her parents to watch Bardo, One Step Further. And then this woman came on, this German woman called Nicole, in a black dress with a white acoustic guitar. And she sang a song called Ein bisschen Frieden, which means a little peace. And I got obsessed with her. I made my primary school teacher, who we used to do guitar club at school. I wanted to paint my guitar white. My mum wouldn't let me.
Brilliant.
But I made him teach me how to play a little piece on my little guitar. And
you bought that record
as
well?
When winter begins. Oh, yeah, still got it. Just like a...
Go sing it, Angela, sing it. Go on, sing
it.
No,
I'm not, because I can't sing to save my life. No, I'm not going to. But do listen to it. It's gorgeous.
A little piece.
And of course, it was called A Little Piece. And it was the year when Greenham Common was a really big deal. And you listen to our previous episode on the Abel Archer 83, and you'll see all the stuff that was going on in 82 and 83. So to have a song from Germany, from West Germany, called A Little Piece...
Getting 12 points from Israel.
Which was a big deal to get 12 points from Israel for a German country. That was the first time that had happened.
Because we were in the middle of the Falklands and no one was voting for us.
No one voted for us. We did. Yeah. And it was a good song. I stand by that. I still like the song One Step Further and I Would Have Been There. Anyway.
But so Bardo, you basically abandoned your British cheering for Bardo and switched to Germany. And you've had a love of Germany ever since, and all things German.
I have. I think it's where it started. I genuinely do think it's where it started with Nicole and the 1982 Eurovision.
Thank you, Nicole.
But yeah, we did really badly because it was the Falklands and no one voted for us.
And the French didn't even enter because Mitterrand had just won the French election and his Minister of Culture was so snobby and thought it was so vulgar and awful, Eurovision, that he wouldn't let France take part.
It was beneath them.
They came back the following year.
No.
By this point, they were doing announcements in three languages, you know, English, French and German. So in 83, it took 16 minutes before they got to the first song. And in the Turkish song that year is often cited as the worst ever. It's got opera, jazz and back to opera again. And they were disgraced back home.
Threw all the shit at the wall, didn't they, Turkey? They were like, we'll do all the styles in one style. Yeah.
And he went back home and he was told he'd let the entire nation down.
Yeah. Well, they were really trying to... impress Europe, when they wanted to be part of Europe. And they genuinely thought that he'd done so badly that I like to call it Turkey's Turkey.
Oh, John, very good.
See what I've done there?
See what he did.
But he'd done so badly that they felt it damaged their chances of ever being accepted into Europe. And
Turkey's
he ended up
Turkey.
Living the rest of his life as a recluse.
Yeah.
The guy who sung it.
Now he's going to hear this and he's going to hear you just call it Turkey's Turkey. He's going to be back into therapy again. So, I mean, the popularity of the countries, you know, at any given point was reflected in the voting, I think. In 84, England was booed because football hooliganism had been running riot across the country.
Well, it was held in Luxembourg, and that's exactly where hooliganism, I think, just 6 months earlier had
been. Right. Yeah, and then some people thought it was a common agricultural policy, but I'm not sure the average Eurovision fan is into that.
We're too worried about that, no.
Sweden comes back in 85 again. What was...
My favourite song title. Oh, I've got two favourite song titles from the whole of Eurovision. One is 1985, was Bra Vibrationer, which, to be fair, it means good vibrations in Sweden, but Bra Vibrationer is a great... I might do a show called Bra Vibrationer. and my second favourite goes back to 1978. My second favourite title ever of a song in Eurovision was just called... It was from Austria, and it was called Mrs. Caroline Robinson.
Okay.
Which apparently is about a witch turned sex goddess.
Okay.
Because nothing says sex goddess like the name Caroline Robinson. Sorry to any Caroline Robinsons listening. I'm sure
that's
you are
funny.
A sex goddess.
Yeah, so you can see that Eurovision was changing with more risque songs. And Europe, of course, is changing too, Angela. You see how I brought the two together there.
Well done. You're the king of the segue.
The Berlin Wall is coming down. They'd had two songs about the wall in 1990 and they did very badly. Maybe that's from Germany.
The wall came down 9th of November 1989.
You were there?
My 13th birthday.
Oh, no, 13th
I think I might have mentioned
right.
it once or twice.
You have, yes. but then suddenly you got all these new countries wanting to take part, you know, Macedonia and Bosnia and everything. So they had so many entrants that they ruled that the worst performing countries couldn't come back next year.
Finally, a bit of bloody jeopardy in the
relegation. It's like, so Luxembourg's, one of the originals, was stopped from coming back. And they went off in a huff and never came back.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez. Out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
They were like,
they
we were there
come
in the
back
beginning.
Luxembourg.
I don't think they have. It's what it said in the book. It said they walked out permanently.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Come on, Luxembourg. Yeah. It was years ago. Come on, come back.
So, Ireland. Let's go back to Ireland. 1990s.
Yes.
Ireland
yes.
just kept winning.
Ireland
it.
Ruled.
Yeah. And they, but the thing was, it became a bit of a pain for them because, of course, the winner hosts it. They're sort of bankrupting the Irish nation, having to host Eurovision every year. It was a little town of Mill Street down in the south in Munster there. 1993, some local entrepreneur goes, well, we'll do it in the town. We'll do it in the town. Me and the boys. So we'll put a stage up in the square. And they did. They did it. They put the whole thing in. The government said, all right, if you reckon you can put on Eurovision in your little town. Somebody should do a movie about
off
this.
You go.
Because they did Eurovision in like a two-horse town in the south of the Republic. I was doing a sketch show on Radio 4 then. And we did a parody of the Irish song, which was like, so, because they were so determined to lose, we had sort of like, yeah. Oh, well, I'll play it. We'll see if we can play a little clip of it.
Yeah.
Kate Robbins,
didn't you, sang it?
That was Kate Robbins singing that, who actually represented England back in 1980. So we've got her doing our Eurovision parody. We've got a parody sung by an actual Eurovision.
The Belgians are fat. The English love animals. Let's strangle a cat. We hope that this ballad has made it quite clear. We don't want to host your damn contest next year.
Thank you.
And of course, Father Ted did My Lovely Horse as a possible Irish entry, which...
Best episode ever.
Yeah, which is a great one.
Yeah.
But
well, 94.
The best thing of any of this is where I get on my Irish patriotic horse again, is Riverdance. I never forget watching Riverdance and ringing my dad up afterwards and going, that was incredible. Did you see
that?
Well,
for people who don't know, I mean, it was the 1994 song contest in Dublin.
Right.
At the point in Dublin.
Yeah.
It was a big deal that year anyway, because it was the first year that four former Soviet bloc countries, a couple of Baltic states, and Russia itself had joined in. So you suddenly had 25 entrants in the competition, more than there'd ever been. A week before that, the Channel Tunnel had just opened. So Europe's looking different. Yeah. And then you've got this amazing set in Dublin that had been built for it. And the interval happens.
And you think,
Flatley and Gene Butler come out. Well, I know you're very Irish and patriotic, John, and that Riverdance means a lot to you, but I will just remind people that in 1974, we had the Wombles.
The best of Europe didn't have the Wombles on their telly. So it was like, what the hell's this thing going on? Wombles?
What the fuck is this?
But when Gene Butler and Michael Flatley did that dancing, I was blown away. And
it was mesmerising.
And I rang my dad up immediately afterwards, and he'd rung his brother up. It was a big deal. My voice is cracking when I think about it. And
John.
I went to my daughter to learn Irish dancing. She's like, I'm not bloody doing that, Dad, you know. I will say, I thought Wogan got the mood wrong then, because everyone was going, that was incredible. He's going, oh, sturdy on. Oh, well, it was time to take the piss out of it. And it was like, I mean, Wogan was great for Eurovision. He was always pleasantly sardonic about the over-the-top acts. I think when it sailed to the very greatest heights, as it did that year, I don't think he quite got the mood right, because everyone loved it.
Well, Wogan, should we do a little Wogan segue? Because I read a really interesting article about him from 2016. So he presented it for 35 years.
Wow.
Until Graham Norton took over in, I think it's not longer than that. Is it 38 years? I think it's 2008.
Yeah.
Graham Norton took over. And his shtick was he did the sort of wry, sardonic asides and did take the piss a little bit, which, let's be honest, was brilliant television.
Yeah,
right?
And
made it worth watching. But in 2016, so in the run-up to the Brexit referendum, the Swedish Eurovision producer that year was a guy called Christer Björkman, and he launched this, and Terry Wogan had just died as well.
Right.
And he launched this attack against Terry Wogan. No. He said it created a generation of Britons who see the show as irrelevant and kitsch, which, newsflash, guys, it is. He said it hadn't helped the British perception of Europe. Sandy Shaw came out at the same time, and she said that the BBC used the event to make fun of and belittle other countries, and that we always send our worst offerings instead of our best. And if we sent our best, it would help raise the standard of everyone. And they were basically the thing that they were sort of blaming the anti-Europe sentiment in Britain on Terry Wogan.
Brexit happened because Wogan has a funny sense of humour.
Because Wogan took the piss out of some...
No, I don't think that stands up.
There was a good counterbalance to that to prove that wasn't the case. Because, yes, you had Wogan on one side, but on the other side, you had Henry Kelly and Going for Gold. And he did wonders for European relations. Because to me, when I think of Europe as a union, I think of those wonderful contestants waving on Going for Gold. And
I think we all enjoyed Wogan's sort of lack of reverence for it, and I think it was sort of appropriate.
Absolutely.
But I think there was, you know, the attitude to countries and the way they were voted for, you know, was reflected in the results, and it became clear as the Eastern European countries entered it that there was block voting going on. You know, Cyprus was always voting for Greece, and you know, all this always went on. In 1997, when Labour had its landslide on the 1st of May. You have to remember that Thatcher and Major had been very against Europe, and Europe had got very fed up with that Conservative government. 2 days later, Blair was elected with a pro-European landslide, and then UK won a landslide with Katrina and the waves. And it was almost as if it was like two landslides in one weekend.
I think that episode, the 97 episode, was the last episode I ever watched of Eurovision. Actually sat and watched it all. And the reason I watched it, I was doing a night shift at the time.
Wow.
I was at university, but I was working in an old people's home, and I was doing a night shift. And so I had Eurovision on all night. Yeah.
I was so excited about the election result. And I talked to a neighbour about it, said, wasn't it brilliant? She goes, oh, I watched all of that. I said, me too, Portillo. She goes, oh, I'm so sure Ireland were going to win again. Oh, you're talking about Eurovision. You're not talking about the election. That was also the year that was, amazingly, it's 97, it's not that long ago, but it's the first year there was an openly gay entrant. Iceland had
it's
a...
It's mad, isn't it? It's that recent.
But you know, the social attitudes were different before 97. Labour would change a lot of the laws, lower the age of consent and bring in civil partnerships. Europe, it was already a big sort of camp fest and hugely popular with gay audiences.
Which is why it does seem, 97 does seem late to have an openly gay entrant when it was already, like you say, a camp celebration by that point.
And then in 1998, social attitudes clearly changing very rapidly when Dana International won it for Israel. First transsexual winner, Angela.
Yeah, first transsexual winner.
Dana clearly referencing the Dana of 1970.
Yeah.
But yeah, and people were prepared to vote for Dana International. Yeah. And it was
a big win as well. It wasn't
Clearly a major cultural shift was happening.
And absolutely.
There were death threats. 2002, there was a drag act representing Slovenia.
Yeah.
Maybe that affected their applications to join the EU. I don't know. But it's about this time that UK's decline starts, and you could actually see the voting bloc sort of falling away. So as I say, Terry Wogan takes over. Terry Wogan retires in 2008.
Graham Norton takes over, and sort of I think I can't think of anyone really better to take the baton from Terry Wogan than Graham Norton.
2014, you had Conchita Wurst.
Yeah.
Winning?
Did she win? I think she
won.
I can't
remember. Yeah. Yeah, she won, apparently.
So that was
our producer is nodding. Our producer is obviously a massive Eurovision fan. There's a story around that time about a slightly political one from Azerbaijan. From Armenia. And people in Armenia voting for the... Because you're doing it by telephone voting by now. People in Azerbaijan who were voting for the Armenian or texting their votes for the Armenian entry were visited by the police in Azerbaijan saying, why are you texting your vote to Eurovision? So it's like that's how much it meant to them. But that's how much of a police state that was.
Gosh.
2015, Europe got so big that it included Australia.
Australia's in Europe and we're not.
No, 2015 that was, 2015.
Why did Australia?
Because they love it. Just because they love it so much. And they went, all right, you can be in it. I think it's great. They went, all right, Australia can
be
in it.
Yeah. Yeah, why not? I mean, I know it's called Eurovision, but it doesn't matter, does it?
And everyone thinking, oh my God, if they win it, does that mean everyone's got to go all the way over there? But always, you know, big rainbow flags flying, and the Australian had a big sort of gay community that loved it as well. But there was a sort of controversy because you're only allowed to wave flag. They decided you're only allowed to wave the national flags of countries entering. And they went, oh, and the EU flag, you can fly that. What, so no Welsh flag or no rainbow flag? All right, you can have rainbow flag, Welsh flag. All right, can we have the independence for Nagorno-Karabakh? Oh, I just want peace. I just want everyone to be happy.
Can we all just wave white flags and that's done with it?
And then poor is it Suri in 2016? There was a stage invasion and protests about Nazis in the British media, which ruined her entry, poor thing. She was offered the chance to go again, but she didn't take it. I think she probably knew England wasn't going to win it anymore anyway.
Well, yeah, it's a bit pointless at that point, isn't it? Yeah. You're not going to... Although maybe if she'd gone again and smashed it, people might have felt sorry for her.
Yeah. But, you know, Eurovision today, all, you know, full of outrageous acts, and it's sort of almost imploding in its campness, and it's sort of...
It's a bit... I mean, I stopped watching it quite a while ago, and I think... I don't know if it's as enjoyable now because it's so self-aware. I think it was more fun when it was sort of unintentionally.
It was on the cusp.
Sort of camp and.
Yeah.
Or you know, that didn't have that self-awareness. Whereas
trying
now
too hard. I mean, sort of got, you know, you got joke acts and heavy metal acts from Scandinavia, and it's a long, long way from the stage show of the 1950s. And it's become increasingly sexual as well, with sort of leather jock straps. I don't know if you look up on YouTube.
John, I just have to point out at this moment that in your notes that you've sent me, you've referred to them as jock traps, which I think is a much better, name.
Leather jock
them.
Traps. check out the Polish Milkmaids in 2014. You've never seen such a soft porn act.
Come on.
She's churning the butter. Like, there's some sort of imagery going on there. I can't quite get it as the pole goes up and down in her hands and her heaving bosoms like lunge towards the camera.
Nigella sort of levels of...
Yeah. In fact, and it's, you know, the sexuality is so overt now that there was a lesbian kiss and Turkey pulled out. In 2014, I think it was, when they realised
that... When they knew that was going to happen, didn't they?
Yeah. Or maybe they just thought Britain's putting in Engelbert Humperdinck and we're out of here. I don't know.
See you later. But I forgot we'd done that, you know.
God, yeah. But over the decades, it's been a mirror by which you can see how Europe has changed and how England's standing in Europe has declined. The respect for in which we're held, which is a sad sort of signifier.
Yeah, I think that's also why a lot of us have lost interest in it, because you're just like, well, we're never going to win it again.
We're never going to win. It's not fair because it's not done like, you know, at least when you watch the Eurovision, the football competition, you think we either win or lose, but you know that it's going to be countries voting for each other and it's not on the basis of how good the song is. Mm. I think we've skipped along through 80 years or whatever it is, 70 years of Eurovision there.
Got a couple of stats to finish on.
Go on.
If you're 52 countries in total have participated at least once.
Wow.
It's quite a lot, isn't it? Germany's competed more times than any other country. They've only missed one.
Okay.
And Ireland, of course, we know holds the record for the most victories, having won 7 times in total.
Come on.
Including
now.
Johnny Logan, who won twice.
Yeah.
And in the 1990s, they had 4 victories in 5 years.
That's amazing. Well done, Ireland.
Actually, it's quite amazing as well, because that really reflected in the 90s, their economy was starting to boom.
Yeah, and you
it?
Had
a real sort of boom time.
And they were winning football matches with the late Jack Charlton, and you had Father Ted coming along. Great time to be from Maidenhead, Angela.
What's the phrase? Plastic Paddy?
Thank you, Eurovision, for entertaining us. Thank you, everyone, for listening over the last 28 episodes of this series.
Yes, we're going to take a little break. We've got stuff to get done. It's really fun researching these episodes, but it does mean I get absolutely nothing else done.
I know, and I haven't read a novel for bloody months because I'm sitting there reading histories of Eurovision or the Black Death. My wife's going, what are you reading? It's like, I'm reading about the Spanish Civil War. It's like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah, that's light.
So thank you for
your
comments.
I'm going to go read some Mills and Boone, keep it light for a bit.
Yeah, but you can keep listening to them
and
recommending
them
to your friends.
And keep engaging with us on Twitter and stuff, because we do read them and we do make a list of the things you want to hear about. We will be back. That's an absolute promise. We'll be back in the autumn. So have a lovely summer.
Thank you to Spike, our producer.
Stay safe.
I hope things are easing up a bit when we wear a mask and just...
Wear a bloody mask.
Stay alert. That's the advice I follow from the...
Let's not go down that road.
All right.
And we'll see you in the autumn.
We'll see you then. We'll play out now. We'll play out now with a little piece.
Oh, just play out with a bit of a little piece.
We'll do that for you, Angela.
Oh,
see you guys.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Wie ein Feuer im eisigen Wind, wie eine Puppe, die keiner mehr mag, fühl ich mich an manchem Tag. Dann seh ich die Wolken, die über uns sind, und höre die Schreie der Vögel im Wind. Ich sing aus Angst vor dem Dunkeln mein Lied und hoffe, dass nichts geschieht. A little love, a little given to build a dream for the world we live in. A little patience and understanding for our tomorrow. A little peace, a little sunshine, feel gladness to wash away all the tears of sadness. A little hoping, a little chanson, mais pourquoi me taire, y'a pas de raison, pour faire la guerre c'est mieux que galant, y'a qu'à trouver l'unisson. Een beetje vrede, een beetje liefde, waarom de wereld.